we present the News Quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello, and welcome again to the News Quiz. We start with the classified ad seen in the Heart of Wales Chronicle, read by Peter Donaldson.
For sale, bicycle with slight front damage and broken bell. Would suit trick cyclist or short-distance sprinter.
Thanks, Mrs. K. Murphy, for that. Let's meet the teams. Please welcome first on my right, Andy Hamilton and Linda Smith. Opposite them on my left, Alan Corran, and a newcomer to the News Quiz, Jeremy Vine. Andy, whose military manoeuvrings have gone down in flames.
Well, this was a statement by the Chief of the Armed Forces, who said that he got up and he said it's actually very bad, that the fact that the soldiers will have to go off firefighting is very bad for their morale. It's because Johnny Fire's a tricky beggar. and with war about to break out, you know, it means that they'll be about to storm Baghdad alongside their American colleagues when suddenly they'll have to rush back to get a cat out of a tree and serve it. And what is to stop Iraqi insurgents going around London throwing cats up trees, knowing that that will completely paralyse our armed forces? And it's this whole thorny problem of the fire dispute, which, as I speak, as I understand it, is still on, and we're due for an eight-day fireman strike. So my advice is, if you're going to have a fire, have a small one and make it last 9 days. basically a very serious issue, and I think the really important aspect that hasn't been discussed is the very real danger presented by John Prescott's sentences. Have you? I tried to listen to a John Prescott sentence the other night. I mean, you'd start, you know, it's like reading Proust. You start off with good intentions, but you're never going to make it. And I tried to think, what does it sound like? And it actually sounds like two old ladies gossiping over the back of a fence. Because the way he says, and I said to them at that meeting on the 11th, although notwithstanding the stuff in The Guardian today, which is complete rubbish, but I said to them, and this was before the meeting of the 15th. This is the 15th. And if factoring in the whole question of residuality, and I said to them, and...
I did once interview John Prescott on Newsnight about trains, and we had a load of very technical questions to ask him, and I think I managed three or four. And his answers went on and on and on a bit more. But at the end of it, I felt we'd done a decent enough job until the following day when The Sun printed a full page, which was just the interview. They reprinted the whole of the interview, word for word, under the headline, "Our campaign is launched for the return of the full stop."
And then he started, you know, playing the Trump card of, oh, well, you know, it's not very good to go on strike when there's talk of threats to the tube and stuff. But, I mean, we have nothing to worry about on the tube. There's no way any terrorist is going to be able to attack the tube because it's got the perfect defence. The perfect defence of the tube is its unreliability. Because any terrorist trying to plan a strike, you know, months of planning, they can synchronise their watches all they like. But if they get on the district line and all services terminate at Parsons Green, where there's a specially laid-on bus...
Britain's most senior military man, Admiral Sir Michael Boyce, said that keeping 19,000 soldiers on standby to cover striking firemen could jeopardise plans to attack Iraq. His position is understandable. After all, it was only a couple of years ago that a soldier caught messing around with a fireman's hose would have been court-martialed immediately. Linda, why is it no longer the students that are revolting?
Because the Labour backbenchers and frontbenchers as well. In fact, the Labour Party, really, is rebelling over these top-up fees. Now, you know, your likes of Claire Short and Frank Dobson and quite a lot of others don't seem to understand that unless you institute this sort of system, you really cannot have an elitist two-tier education system in this country.
Got that at all.
They haven't grasped it at all. I mean, it's surprising to see so many Labour MPs be so rebellious. It's a bit One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, isn't it? With Clare Shorter as the rebellious Jack Nicholson figure, and I suppose Frank Dobson, because everyone thought he was either, I don't know, retired to run a post office in Cornwall, or perhaps getting his sleigh ready for Christmas, was it? Suddenly he's like the chief, isn't
the
he?
Mad
he's
Indian.
The mad Indian. Well, yeah. He's not mad, was he just quiet? It's not the same.
Yeah.
And that would be him. But then, oh, then that would mean he'd have to stifle Clare Short with... Oh, I wish I'd never started this one. But there's also this talk of a graduate tax, wasn't it, as an alternative to this, that they wouldn't pay while they were students, but then when they graduated, then they'd start paying. And I think I can see the appeal of that. Maybe they should use that across the board. I think pensioners have an easy ride, don't they?
That yes.
Maybe once they've had their pension, at the end there should be some sort of ghost tax.
Yes.
So they can repay their
in
debt.
In recognition of the
exactly.
money the state has given them
yeah.
to have the pension.
Yeah, to buy cat food and packets of tea and God knows what.
Yeah.
This week, Downing Street admitted the Cabinet was split over proposals for top-up fees for university students. Prime Minister's spokesman said difficult issues were causing vibrant debate in the Cabinet, but things had calmed down once Robin Cook had left the room. Jeremy, welcome to the news quiz. What left Spanish fishermen swearing?
This is this massive oil slick that's come out of a ship called the Prestige. And it's interesting the two government reactions to it, because the Spanish government sees this slick 30 miles long of oil, fuel, in the sea and drenches it in special chemicals, and the British government sees it and puts VAT on it. But you know, we wonder at these stories. They happen again and again and again. These ships leave harbour with all this oil on board, and then they snap in two. And is it a very simple and obvious question to ask why they're carrying oil in ships that keep snapping in two? Could they be designed differently? Are they leaving the harbour in two pieces? Is that the problem here? Have we missed something? They've got a dotted line along the middle with the words "cut here" around it.
There was a very moving moment on the news. One of your colleagues on the news had a crab. Do you see the crab?
Stephen Sacker.
This little guy. He said,
yes.
This little guy and the crab, and it'll never grow up to be eaten by me, is what he said. And it was dying in his hand. I think this is much, much too emotional.
But I saw that, and I saw Stephen Sacker with it. He said, and we found this oil-covered crab. And my first thought was, how very convenient.
Yes.
I think given that the ships have this tendency to split in the middle, I actually think they shouldn't sail along places called the Coast of Death. Because it's La Costa del Muerte. I think the clue is in the name. And they should maybe avoid rocky bits.
There was a quote from a Spanish official who, and I wrote it down, he said, "The best thing that could have happened to the Prestige was for it to sink." Now, what kind of incentive is that to the people who build these things?
The tanker sank off the Spanish coast this week, causing huge environmental damage. As it was towed out of Spanish waters, the ship left a huge slick of oil trailing behind it, a condition marine scientists refer to as the Portillo effect.
Oh.
2 points to Jeremy. Alan, whose body of work has found its audience?
This is Gunther von Hagens.
He sounds nice.
Cuts up bodies. And well, he can't be all bad. He's German, but he is a man who comes over here, or has been over here, and he carried out the first public autopsy for 170 years, and sadly he got this stiff and charged, I think, 12 quid a head. Well, as it were. 12 quid a head for people to come and watch him, and they all felt rather ill, and it wasn't the event they thought. It's a stage past Damien Hirst. It is an event, and he sold it as an educational lecture, and people ought to see bodies cut up because they would understand much more about, you know, their own insides. He is clearly nuts.
I listened to a phone-in and people were quite divided, but one of the... A few things that puzzled me. One caller said that it helped her to understand about her internal organs and resolved her to sort of look after herself better. And you thought, well, No, all you really need to know about your internal organs is that they should stay on the inside. Also, there were a few callers who were saying that the instruments he was using were like what people used 30, 40 years ago, because there are high-tech things now which can open up a skull quickly and efficiently, but presumably they don't make that nice grinding sound that a hacksaw makes, you know. But also, the body, I was a bit intrigued by this horrible process called plastination. I hope no one's eaten while they're listening to the repeat. Plastination is they drain the body of body fluids and replace them with plastics. I hope IKEA don't hear about this.
Controversy has arisen about whether being publicly dissected in front of a live audience crosses the bounds of decency. But then Celebrity Big Brother is for charity. We start round two with a sign seen in Safeway on the self-service cake shelf.
Please do not handle the goods. Use the tongues provided.
Thanks to Malcolm Shine for that. Andy, why will we soon be hearing set and fair gendarme, Gov?
What? What was that language?
It's a fair cop. It is the worst. Leave it.
Oh, is this... Are we going to have French police people coming over?
Yes, 2 points.
Euro detectives. Are they going to patrol the streets in coloured costumes? Colourful costumes?
I think they will do, and I think they might be... Their voices might be slightly out of sync with their lips. It
means a chase can continue for a full 5 hours in Britain without British police being informed. So you're in the centre of Manchester, and you suddenly see a fleet of French motorcyclists chasing, you know, a guy who's just held up a truffle shop in Paris. It's quite exciting, actually, when you think about it. It's going to make life a lot more
especially
exciting.
Especially if they have special chase music. Yeah. It'll be especially exciting.
But how can it be hot pursuit? Because if they got across the channel, they've either got to come on a ferry or a plane.
They're going to run around.
So we're going to be on ferries. There are going to be all these Italian policemen running around saying, he went that way.
Under the Crime International Cooperation Bill, foreign detectives will be allowed to operate on British soil for the first time ever. It will, however, now be possible to arrest people in this country for actions which are not technically criminal in Britain. So there's a chance at last we'll see Noel Edmonds behind bars. Linda, listen to this.
He'd take a little pebble from the riverbed. He'll drop it in the water. Then catch it on his head. For this! That an otter likes better. And an otter, water, no.
Linda, why are otters the talk of the town?
They are the talk of the town because otters are moving into the cities. I don't know, they've been driven there by, I think, second homers, yeah. Really, isn't it?
That's right.
Buying up their halts.
Rich weasels have driven them out
of their halts. And did actually have quite a nasty incident the other day. Left me back door open, and an urban otter, really leery little Jamie Oliver type, you know, war pucker type otter, comes into my kitchen and grabs a lovely bit of haddock off the counter there. Terrible. Made off with it. We had to have Pop-Tarts Mornay that night.
Until recently, otters have not travelled to urban areas, mainly because even if they can afford a car, their little wet feet keep sliding off the clutch. Alan, why will you only be able to find an English country garden in Scotland?
This is about climate change.
It is.
And, well, because of something that's happening to scientists who understand more about this than I do, the world is getting warmer and we should all have olive trees and palm trees and cactus in our gardens, and it'll be the death of the English lawn. Oh, I know about that. I've got a lawn like a billiard table. It's got no grass and it's full of holes. My horticultural knowledge in a nutshell. In cold weather, you get different plants from hot weather. And as we're getting hotter, we're going to get different plants.
A report by the National Trust and the Royal Horticultural Society says global warming could turn English gardens into arid deserts. If global warming carries on this way, the only rows of pansies will be in the chorus line of West End musicals and Qantas stewards. Before we start the final round, here's a cutting from The Guardian.
Sandwell is one of the most deprived areas in the country. For every 100 people who die in the United Kingdom every year, 130 die in Sandwell.
Thanks to Ellen Leggett of Cambridge for that. I don't know how she pronounced her name. Thanks to Ellen Leggett, Leggett of Cambridge for that. Thanks, Ellen Liggett from Cambridge.
Is that an interactive thing you're doing there? They press the red button for the pronunciation they want at home.
Are you sure that's how they pronounce Cambridge?
Andy, listen to this. Andy, which ape men just didn't get the point of Spears?
Right, well, this is the revelation. They've dug up lots of bones and loads of fossils and flints and stuff. And they've come to the conclusion that prehistoric cavemen invented the spear but didn't think about throwing it. And so there are only two possible ways they could have hunted in that case. Either prehistoric man was fantastically fast and could run alongside a gazelle and spear it, shove his spear in the side, or more likely, they built deep pits so they would then they'd kind of corral a saber-toothed tiger, then they disguised the pit, and the saber-toothed tiger would fall down into the pit. But given that they didn't know yet about the wonder of throwing the spear, presumably at that point one of the cavemen has to go down into the pit to finish off the saber-toothed tiger by jabbing his spear into him. And I think they probably had a vote on it. And I think it's a moment like that you'd find out who your friends were. But this is it, yes. Prehistoric man, he'd done the hard bit. He'd invented the pointy, sharp thing. But throwing just...
We don't believe that, though, do we? We can't. You don't. Throwing is not something you discover. I mean, this came well after they had fire. And someone would have said, throw another log on the fire, and he would just look at the log, and the fire would have gone out. I mean, you don't discover throwing. It's there on the end of your arm.
They might not have used the spears for the killing. They might have just waited for a saber-toothed tiger to die quite naturally, then used the spears for sweet corn. Round the fire that they'd recently discovered.
It may have been an early brain thing. I mean, they may have thrown the wheel. They may have made this wheel and thought, there's no use for that, we'll throw it. And they didn't actually think the spear. They put the spear on carts, and this bloody thing's not going anywhere. It's stuck in the ground. Throw a wheel at it, see if it moves.
Monkeys throw, don't they? So maybe one of them saw a monkey do it and thought, now there's an idea.
Well, maybe that made them not do it, thinking, I'm better than a monkey.
Yeah, I'm not stupid at his level.
God, perhaps I'm beyond that.
Yeah.
Alan's right, we're only going to know this is true when we find a wagon that, instead of wheels, has four spears. Then we know it's true. Until then, the jury's out.
A new study suggests that Neanderthal man knew how to make spears but lacked the intelligence to throw them. Once regarded as the ancestors of modern humans, Neanderthals are now thought to be a separate offshoot of the human family, rather like George W. Bush. Previous studies have shown that Neanderthal man was much stronger in one arm than the other, even though Channel 5 only started 6 years ago. Linda, for whom was it no laughing matter to be a proper Charlie?
Well, that question always results in the answer being Prince Charles, doesn't it?
And so it does.
Proper Charlie. And this is actually one of his tragic stories, isn't it, of parental abuse, really. This is the terrible confession he made that... when he was a kid at one of his horrible boarding schools, he was in a production of Macbeth. Sorry. Sorry, the Macbeth play. He was in a production of this, and he was doing he had a big dramatic scene where he's meant to be having a nightmare, and he's rolling about under this fog, and he heard this sort of Greco-Germanic laughter in the audience. And it was his dad laughing at his acting, and you almost feel that Prince Charles should be referred to as Child A in this story. And it's just terrible.
I think it was a bit ambitious taking Prince Philip to watch quite a complicated play like Macbeth.
Oh, they're probably... Look, of course they're fighting. They're all jocks, aren't they? Yes. Probably had some tenants extra.
But I heard that his dad sort of poo-pooed his performance, and when he got home, man set the dogs on him.
his father, Prince, Duke of Edinburgh, of course, said, it sounded like the Goons. I thought it was the Goons, which is strange because Prince Charles' impressions of the Goons sound nothing like the Goons, don't they?
I heard a very good Glencoe Massacre joke. You don't hear a lot of good Glencoe Massacre jokes. There's two Campbells.
Sorry, no, we'll stop. Do take it. I'm on the news quiz. We're running a bit late.
No, it's just these two Campbells standing in a glen and saying I could murder a McDonald's. But anyway...
The description of the play that Charles was in the paper I read, it said that when his father laughed, he was lying on a rug, writhing around and moaning. Now, I've read Macbeth a few times, and I'm not sure what scene he's referring to. I don't know whether it's a sort of pornographic version directed by Larry Flint or something like that, but I was left very confused by that.
Maybe it was Prince Philip was lying on a rug and moaning. It's just a syntax problem.
Worse was to come for the young prince when the witches announced he would be king hereafter. And a voice came from the audience saying,
over my dead body.
Jeremy, who got caught by the buzz?
It's quite embarrassing being on this programme when you don't recognise any of the stories. And especially when you present...
You'll get over this.
Especially when you present a news programme. But Alan has helpfully passed me the words Buzz Lightyear, and I do know this story. This is about a man who nicked a toy from a shop. It was a Buzz Lightyear model. And he thought he got away with it. Police chased him. In fact, I think cops from Italy, Germany, Romania, Hungary, and Iraq were called in to chase. chased him all over the place. He ended up, I think, hiding under a bridge. And then just as he thought he got away, the model said... the recorded words, from here to infinity, from here to infinity, which is apparently what Buzz Lightyear says. So they arrested him and he was sent down.
But surely from here to infinity doesn't really narrow the search that much.
I read that Buzz Lightyear said, Buzz Lightyear, permission to engage.
Yes, he did.
That's what he said.
It's a sex toy, was it? What do they mean, permission to engage?
I don't know, it's just... The toy has, like, five standard phrases.
How do you know these?
From here to infinity, permission to engage, help, I'm being stolen and we're under this bush. Because that was the rather quaint part of the story, was he hid under a bush. Which, I don't think he's a master criminal, I'll be honest with you.
The daylight robbery of the £26.99 Buzz Lightyear was said to be the most audacious theft... since the toy was priced at £26.99. Alan, the last question. Who made a splash when the gang failed to show?
Yeah, this is a little boy. It's a cub called Joseph Smith in, I think, County Durham. And he turned up, thinking he was with his team, to take on another swimming team. And nobody else turned up. So he took the other team on and he beat them all. Do you know, I mean, Andy will know this because he knows every football story. You know, my favourite story about bad Scottish football is actually a Beckham joke as well. England go off to play Scotland. And they're in the changing room and Beckham says, I'll tell you what, lads, it's not going to be very hard. Why don't you go off into town? I'll play them on my own. So the other 10 go off into town. And they come back 2 hours later and there's David sitting... in the corner of the changing room, looking a bit dejected. So I say, what happened, David? Did you lose? He said, no, we won 1-0. I said, why are you looking so sad? He said, I was sent off after 10 minutes.
Cubs out Joe Smith swam his way into record books by winning all 12 events at a swimming gala after his fellow pack members failed to turn up. Joe was the only one of 11 team members to turn up fit and ready to compete, which is still one better than Nasser Hussein's England squad. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. Andy.
This was sent in by Betty Lees of London, and it's from Metro. A seemingly devout couple who spent hours bowed before a statue of the Virgin Mary were actually waiting for their mobile to charge. Priests found the pair had been plugging the phone into a socket used to light up the Madonna in a church in Milan. But offered forgiveness. Letting them charge their mobile is a bit like giving them a glass of water, said one.
Linda.
This was sent in by Peter Jade. It's from The Scotsman. A radio buff helped convict himself of electronically eavesdropping on private phone calls by angrily reacting when he overheard someone accuse him of listening into conversations while he was tapping their phone. A court erupted in laughter when it was heard that Blair McKay immediately called up his accuser and said, "That's not true! I don't listen to phone conversations!"
Jeremy.
Well, this is from something called Now magazine, and it's from the 7th of August this year. It's a letter from a reader who's worried. Caroline from Oldham writes, "I have a fabulous bra that allows you to pump air into it to increase your bust size. I'm going on holiday in a few weeks' time, and I want to take it with me. I'm just worried that it will be affected by the air pressure on the plane and might explode or something. Is this likely to happen, or do you think it will be okay to wear?" And the rather simple solution is not to pump it up until you reach your destination.
Alan.
Well, I have one, Simon, from the Brighton Argus. Having admitted that for 2 years he had driven the converted double-decker to various South Coast locations with four women upstairs and a bar area below, Anderson sought to have the charge dismissed on a legal technicality. "I was not running a disorderly house," he said. "It was a disorderly bus." He was fined £5,000.
Thank you all. Let's look at the final scores. Andy and Linda have 13 points, but Jeremy and Alan have lots more. Before we leave you, here's an item from the Warwickshire County Council website.
Warwickshire County Council will shortly be deciding its response to the government's consultation on airport development in the Midlands. These include three different scales of expansion for Birmingham International Airport, options for the expansion of East Midlands Airport, and, most controversially, the development of a large new airport between Coventry and Rugby. This last option would mean the closure of Birmingham.
With that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Linda Smith, Jeremy Vine and Alan Corran. The chairman was Simon Hoggart and the news is read by me, Peter Donaldson. The chairman's script is written by Simon Littlefield, Paul McKenzie and George Poles, and the producer was Simon Nichols.